Thanks for that. Welcome to Newsday. We'll have an update on that Paris attack shortly. We'll also get the latest business news, the sports headlines, including the final lineup for football's Europa League, and hear how teenage hackers might be tempted to give up cyber crime and focus instead on cyber security. Shimer's in the United States.
That's right, Jillian. Hello from the city of Boise, a blue island in the very red state of Idaho. We're in the northwest of the United States for the last leg of our road trip. I've been speaking to loggers, farmers, students, musicians, and refugees about what they make of President Trump's 100 days in office.
So first to France and scenes of panic and fear on the streets of Paris.
Mesdames et messieurs, you have to stay back, please. The area is dangerous because of shotgun. Please stay back. Mesdames et messieurs, vous reculez, s'il vous plaît.
Well, late on Thursday, the French capital was the scene of another terror attack. One policeman was killed, two seriously wounded when a man armed with an assault rifle opened fire on a police van. The incident took place on the most iconic of Parisian avenues, the Champs-Élysées. These eyewitnesses described what happened.
I was walking on the pavement. There was a bus full of police. The man parked just in front of the bus, and then he got out a Kalashnikov, and then he shot six times. I thought it was fireworks. Then he went and hid behind a lorry.
We were moving towards a car, and then I heard two or three shots, but I didn't realize they were shots to start with. And well, then there was just panic all around. Everyone started running down the Champs-Élysées just by instinct. I didn't stop to work out what was going on. I just ran too.
Olivier Guitta is with the security and counter-terrorism company Global Strat. What did he make of latest developments from Paris?
There was really a major risk of a terror attack in the run-up to the French presidential election. The Minister of Interior of France had warned that the risk of a terror attack was at the maximum level. Both Islamic State and Al-Qaeda had called for their followers to strike France in the run-up to the election. And just 2 days ago, two major jihadists were arrested in Marseille. They were planning an attack in the next few days, also on a large-scale level.
What about the location? I mean, it couldn't be more French. It is a representation of France and Paris and the capital, the iconic Champs-Élysées.
That's exactly the modus operandi of Islamic State that specifically targets symbols, but also tourism areas. They want to cripple the different economies, as we've seen in other countries in the world.
Along with this claim of responsibility from so-called Islamic State, they've put forward a name, Abu Youssef the Belgian, and that once again throws a spotlight on a country, Belgium, from where there seem to have been an awful lot of terror suspects operating there.
The main point would be actually the fact that Islamic State claims responsibility within just 2 hours of the attack, which is very unusual for them, which makes me believe that this individual was part of the network rather than just being inspired or linked.
There are going to be all sorts of questions, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of finger-pointing with people, especially during an election campaign, saying the authorities aren't doing enough. But you do wonder to what extent you can actually prevent something like this happening.
You're totally correct. I was in France just yesterday. The presence of soldiers and police in the street is just mind-boggling. I mean, we're talking about 50,000 soldiers and police around France to secure different landmarks and also the polling booth for Sunday's election. And we're talking about 15,000 potential jihadists on the terror watch list just in France.
There's this terrible expression, which is terrorism is the new normal, but I guess that is the reality for a country like France today.
Yes, this is the new normal, and it has been the new normal since September of 2014, actually, when the spokesman of Islamic State called on its followers, you know, in the West to stay at home, not go to Syria or Iraq, and target the homeland. So that was the inflection point, if you will, of this new normal. We're talking about 7 foiled attacks in France since the beginning of the year in just 3 months. That's the new normal.
Olivier, thank you so much for your time. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Julian.
Hello and welcome to the Gem State that is Idaho, a conservative state with a big rural community. Idaho voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump, and as his 100 days in office approach, we are in the Northwest to see what people make of his presidency so far. We're in downtown Boise, that's the capital. It is not rural. It could not be different from its surroundings. It's actually a really bustling area, restaurants all around us in downtown. We're in Bitter Creek Ale House, and we're not far from the Basque block. Actually, it's one block away, I'm told, and there's a big Basque community here. I'm here with Mayor David Beter, Mayor of Boise, Basque American. Welcome to the program, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Welcome to the BBC, to Boise.
Thank you so much. Am I right in understanding you're the only Basque-speaking mayor in the whole of the United States?
That's true. That's true.
That's quite a thing to have on a T-shirt.
Well, it's Wikipedia says it, and it happens to be true.
And tell our listeners a little bit about Boise.
Well, Boise is where the desert meets the mountains. Mm-hmm. It's right on the threshold of that. And geographically, that's very good to us. They have a beautiful river that runs through us.
But the Boise River, I've been walking along it all week long. Beautiful.
It's a little high right now, yeah. So that's a little nervous, but it is in the northern Rockies at the foothills of it. So from us north, it gets there are foothills and then higher mountains. It's a very beneficial to us. We are a remote city. We're the farthest away from a city of 100,000 people or more. Salt Lake is the closest, 5 hours away. We kind of like it that way. We have to grow our own things here, our own businesses, our own cultural activities, everything from here.
We'll talk about businesses, and we'll also talk about President Trump's 100 days in office. Now, as the mayor said, this is as far from the capital as you can get around this area. And what is Idaho known for? Potatoes. Seriously, there are number plates here that have the phrase famous potatoes on them. It's a big business, big employer, big part of the economy. And I spent a morning on a potato farm and spoke to Doug Gross, the owner, who told me about his concerns for his business and how big potatoes are in Idaho.
If you talk to people anywhere in the world, they will always bring up potatoes and associate it with Idaho.
Because I know that you travel quite a lot around the world, and when you tell people you're from Idaho, do they know exactly what to associate it with?
Absolutely. That's the first thing that comes out of their mouth.
Tell me about you personally. How long have you been in potato farming? When did you start?
I'm a second generation farmer. I used to help my dad on the farm back in the late 50s. Started farming in 1975.
And never stopped.
And haven't quit yet, no.
I mean, given the scale of it, it does seem like this is quite a stable business. I mean, does it vary quite a lot?
The demand is very flat in the United States. This is a pretty mature industry, but our export business is booming. Trade is very important. International trade is very important to us in Idaho.
Well, let's talk more about international trade, because of course, one of President Trump's policies and big talking points was about trade deals and reevaluating the trade deals America has with the rest of the world, which obviously will affect international trade. Do you follow that quite closely? Is that something that concerns you?
Absolutely, it does. You know, we want good, fair trade deals, but we don't want trade to stop.
What about when Donald Trump says America first, buy American, hire American?
We're in a world marketing situation now, and I don't think you can completely undo all of that. We just want to go back and evaluate the trade pacts that we have and make sure they are fair. His campaign was based on a bunch of sound bites that were, you know, definite, absolute issues without details. And I think the details will eventually filter out and it will all work out. I am optimistic about our future.
I mean, this is a vast, vast area. I mean, all across us, we can see fields. It does seem like a lot of work has been put into this part where we're walking right now, where the potato seed has been laid. Tell me about your workforce here.
Potatoes are a pretty automated crop. We use a lot of technology, but we have some concerns about the future for employees.
Why is that?
80% of our employees are Hispanic. Of those, I would say that half did come from Mexico. And we have some concerns about the Mexican border and the wall that he's threatened to put up, and how that might shorten our labor force in the United States and in agriculture specifically.
My name is Rafael Luna, and I work for Gross Farms.
You've been here for over a decade now. Tell me what it's been like for you working here.
When I first got here, I didn't know anything about English. I mean, it's just...
Where did you move from?
From Mexico, from Guadalajara. And from Guadalajara, I've been here since 99. I came here to work. I met my wife here.
When Donald Trump got elected, and before that when he was campaigning, he spoke a lot about the Mexican community, about borders with Mexico, about immigration and border control. And I'm just wondering, watching all of this, and now with the Trump administration in place for nearly 100 days, what do you make of all of that?
He needs to meet all the people. He needs to talk about the people to do all the job. I don't think he knows the community. And I think he's only just playing the part. He's just doing politics. I don't even think he knows how to grow potatoes or where the potatoes come from.
Are you at all concerned about your life, the life that you've built for yourself, being at risk because of the Trump administration's rhetoric about immigration?
I don't worry my position because, thank God, I'm legal now. But I see other people that are struggling with what he's doing, what he's saying, and what he's about to do.
Rafael Luna there, the manager of the Gross Farm, the potato farm that we were on. And before that, you heard from Doug Gross, the farm owner, about how big the business is, but about his concerns of Donald Trump's rhetoric on migrant workers. Mayor David Beter, Mayor Boise, you're still with us. You are listening to this. What do you make of what you've heard?
Well, you heard a lot of the dissonance that we have in the state. On the one hand, they're for Trump, as the farmer indicated, but they depend on international trade, and they depend on a fair amount of foreign workers. So that's where Idaho is right now. We voted for Trump in pretty big numbers, not in the city of Boise, but they're going to have to live with those results, and there are some real problems with that scenario because we are an exporting state, especially agriculturally, and we depend on a lot of workers to support that agricultural environment.
Now, I understand, of course, that you yourself are a Democrat, Mr. Mayor, and that you oppose Donald Trump's rhetoric and migration policies. But from traveling around the states, and I have been, for example, to Del Rio on the border. I apologize. Too many tortillas. and people are really concerned about border control. They say we need our borders to be secure. We can't just let anybody in. And, you know, it's a real concern. I understand, of course, what Rafael is saying about making a life for himself. But there is also an argument that the borders need to be controlled.
Well, that's the kind of dissonance that we have here. You heard 80% of his workers in the potato industry, in the dairy industry, which is also very important to Idaho. Those are the kind of numbers we see, 80% foreign workers.
Yeah.
And of those undocumented, especially in, not so much in potatoes maybe, but in other agricultural products like dairy, you're talking about 70-80% undocumented. So we can't have that both ways, and we have to resolve that.
So what's the solution then?
I think the solution is immigration policy that's forward thinking, that allows some of that, because eventually those those discrepancies have to be resolved, and that's, I think, what we're going to see in the future.
In terms of Donald Trump's presidency, of course, there have been many, many controversial points. His opponents are saying actually nothing has been achieved, no policy to speak of. His supporters, however, are quite resilient, quite adamant that this was the right choice. What do you make of it?
With any objective view of these first 100 days, it's a train wreck. I mean, he hasn't accomplished anything. Thank God, because I didn't want him to accomplish anything. I think, you know,
Mr. Mayor, come on. He was very assertive on Syria. He drew a line in the sand, and he stuck by his word. Very assertive about ISIS and Afghanistan. And you know, his supporters will tell you that.
His executive orders have been, that's what gives me hope, is that our institutions are holding up well, our court system, Congress to some extent. His executive orders haven't worked, and I'm optimistic, cautiously, that we're going to overcome this.
Mayor David Beter, stay with us for a bit. Now, stay tuned. When we come back, I'll tell you about a popular pastime, fiddling. Why? Find out a little bit later on the program. We're live from Idaho, Boise, Idaho.
More to come from Scheimer and guests a little later. This is Newsday on the BBC World Service. Away from that attack in France, our other top story today, Iran's hardline former president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been prevented from standing in next month's election. Let's have further sports headlines. Hello, Alistair Ross.
Hello, Julian. Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Marcus Rojo picked up potentially serious-looking knee injuries as Manchester United beat Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time to book their place in the Europa League. Lyon, Celta de Vigo and Ajax also on their ties and will go into Friday's draw. The Indiana Pacers have thrown away a 26-point lead to lose Game 3 of their playoff to the Cleveland Cavaliers in their best-of-seven Eastern Conference playoff. The Cavs now lead 3-0. The Milwaukee Bucks are closing in on a 2-1 lead over the Toronto Raptors. It looks like an absolute thrashing there on the Bucks' home court. Tiger Woods is likely to miss the rest of the PGA Tour season after announcing he'd had a fourth surgery on his back. The recovery time from that procedure is normally around 6 months. And the former snooker world champion Neil Robertson says his career was almost derailed by an addiction to computer games. The Australian admits he could easily spend 12 hours a day playing them and says he knows many other players in a similar situation.
Thanks, Alistair. The business day has pretty much come to an end on America's West Coast. Joining us now from Los Angeles to look at some of the business headlines, David Willis. David, the world's financial leaders gathering there in the US, what are they going to be talking about?
That's right, Julian. We're talking, of course, about the spring meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It's taking place in Washington, D.C., on the home turf of an American president who, of course, has been openly scornful of the IMF's goal of an integrated global marketplace, prompting the question, how will the world's financial leaders seek to nudge Donald Trump away from his America First instincts? Mr. Trump, of course, was elected on a pledge to tear up trade agreements that he said were taking jobs away from middle-class Americans and impose tough trade tariffs on China and Mexico. So far, though, he's pulled the US out of the Pan-Pacific Partnership, that's a trade agreement championed by his predecessor, Barack Obama, but taken a softer stance on other issues, scrapping plans to withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement, for example, and rowing back on a promise to label China a currency manipulator. Well, since World War II, the International Monetary Fund has helped America set the agenda for the world economy. How then will it deal with this new age of American protectionism and an administration whose leader, of course, rose to power by harnessing working class anger against the whole notion of free trade? We will find out in the next 3 days, but at a news conference at the start of the gathering, the IMF's managing director, Christine Lagarde, struck an emollient chord. She indicated the organization was willing to work with the Trump administration in achieving what she called a level playing field for trade, Julian, indicating a reduction in government subsidies that, including a reduction in government subsidies that limit competition.
We heard just a moment ago Scheimer in Idaho talking to a potato farmer who said he wants good free trade. Is it clear what the Trump administration's position on free trade actually is?
Well, it's interesting, actually, you should ask that question, because according to one of the top people in the Trump economic team, the director of the White House National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, fair and free trade means what he calls tit-for-tat trade tariffs. The United States, he said a short while ago, doesn't want to be taken advantage of, and lest anyone be in any doubt about that, earlier in the week, Mr. Trump signed a Buy American, Hire American executive order. And just as the IMF and World Bank meetings were getting underway, a few streets away at the White House, he also signed a new directive to study whether cheap steel imports from China and other countries could be restricted. So safe to say, America First remains the hallmark of this administration's economic policy.
Thanks, David. David Willis, live there from Los Angeles. Now, how do you deal with teenage hackers? They've been making the headlines here in the UK for a couple of reasons. First, there's the sentencing of a young hacker who pleaded guilty to charges of developing and selling software that was used for more than 1.5 million attacks on websites worldwide. He's due to appear in court today. Then there's also reports by the country's National Crime Agency saying that teenagers often get involved in cybercrime to impress their peers rather than for financial gain. One man who knows a thing or two about this issue is Vince Warrington. He's been looking at ways to encourage young, talented computer experts to turn away from cybercrime and think instead of a career in his area of expertise, cybersecurity. He's been telling me more about it.
At the moment, we've got a situation where there's a real lack of a career path for cybersecurity. One of the things that people are starting to look at is how do we define that career path? Some of that will be talking with teachers and with parents, and part of it is to work with the industry.
But there's an image problem also, isn't there? Because when we hear the words teenage hacker, straight away you get this image of some sort of computer geek alone in a bedroom, hunched over his laptop and up to no good.
Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the issues I have with the industry in general is that we've relied on this old image of the hooded figure and a glowing computer screen. But really what's happening is when people hear about kids working with computers and potentially doing things like hacking, they're instantly assuming that they're up to no good, they're up to some bad things, they're going to get into trouble with the law, which has happened to some people. But it's almost like we're predisposing people to say that anyone who's taking an interest in computers and how they work and how they can manipulate them from a young age is up to no good. So one of the things that's a real challenge for the cybersecurity industry is for itself to move away from this kind of almost tired old image into something a lot more professional. Just because you're involved in working out how computers operate and how you can manipulate them doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It means that you've got a great talent for actually doing quite a lot of good in the world.
I was going to ask you, these hackers, and you've talked to a fair few, are they necessarily doing something malicious, or do they understand the line between right and wrong?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point, because one of the most common forms of attack is called a DDoS, or a distributed denial of service, which is essentially an attack where somebody floods a computer server with too much data and that computer server can't handle it. And people think, you know, this happens to banks and government a lot. But the people who suffer it the most are the gaming industry, as in computer games rather than casinos and the like, because young people try to knock off the servers that their friends are playing against, or they've got an issue with the games company that's made a change to their favourite game, so they try to destroy the game. So one of the things we need to do is actually get in quite early with people and say that there are some good things you can do with this, but there are also some bad things you can do with this. There's a level of ethics involved in this industry, and you can use exactly the same skills for good that you use for doing the bad thing.
Going from cybercrime to cybersecurity, Vince Warrington there. This reaction in our top story, the aftermath of that attack in Paris. Edgar Shitukutuku in Kitwe in Zambia has texted us to say, any event which claims human lives saddens me. The perpetrators of the Paris shooting must be brought to book. Our text message number is 447786. 205085. Do stay tuned with Newsday here on the BBC World Service, with Julian Keane in London and Shaima Khalil in Idaho, America.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, where we invite you to a very special birthday party.
Life Stories.
I'm Priscilla Nyethe in Kenya, and I'm with someone very, very dear to me. I would love for you to meet her. This is my great-grandmother, Elizabeth Gudoni Koinange.
Thank you.
And today is her birthday. She speaks Kikuyu, so her words have been voiced over in English.
I'm very excited because it's the day I was born and it is my day to celebrate.
Did I mention her age? She's 117 years old. I'm talking to my great-grandmother to find out how it feels to live life at 117.
Celebrating life at 117 at bbcworldservice.com/lifestories.
Hello, welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with Julian Keane in London and Shaima Khalil in the United States. Coming up, more reaction to the Paris shooting. We'll hear what some of the presidential contenders had to say about it. Also, the pastor who's become a symbol of the pro-political reform movement in Zimbabwe. And we'll return to Idaho, where Newsday's Shaima Khalil and guests have been assessing the Donald Trump presidency. All that after a roundup of the latest world news.
François Hollande has promised security forces will maintain absolute vigilance after a policeman was shot dead in central Paris. Two others were wounded in the attack when a gunman opened fire on a police bus on one of the city's main streets, the Champs-Élysées. He kept firing as he tried to flee but was shot dead by police. French media say the suspect was a 39-year-old French national. Police have searched the suspect's home in the eastern suburbs of Paris and are investigating whether the man had any accomplices. The shooting comes just days before the first round of the country's presidential election. Three leading candidates have cancelled campaign events in the wake of the attack. State media in Iran says the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has been disqualified from standing in next month's presidential election. Among those approved by the Guardian Council are the incumbent Hassan Rouhani and the man seen as the leading hardliner, Ibrahim Raisi. Riot police in the Venezuelan capital Caracas have fired tear gas and rubber bullets at thousands of opposition demonstrators taking part in a second day of protests against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Masked activists hurled stones and petrol bombs at police. Japanese media say the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has sent a spring festival gift to the controversial Yasukuni Shrine. Those honoured there include leaders convicted of war crimes during the Second World War. Neighbouring countries consider the shrine a symbol of Japanese militarism. New research suggests that consuming artificially sweetened drinks on a daily basis may increase the risk of strokes and dementia. The study found that people who consumed at least one diet drink a day were three times as likely to suffer a stroke or dementia as people who consumed less than one such drink a week. BBC News.
Thanks. Hello. Welcome to Newsday. This half hour, we're going to be looking at the flag as a symbol of political change in Zimbabwe. And we'll find out what it's been like for millions of people in Cameroon to have lived without the internet for 3 months. Your comments always welcome. The text message number is 447786 205085. You might want to send some questions to Shima, who's live today in the United States. I could actually say Ongi Etori. That's welcome in Basque, which I think at least one of your guests speaks.
Our Basque American mayor is laughing with approval, Julian, and Americans are taking stock of President Trump's first 100 days. Today, we get the view from Idaho in the northwest of the United States.
Well, let's go first to France, where we had expected the news there to be dominated by the final TV appearance of the presidential contenders ahead of Sunday's election. Instead, the headline in today's Figaro newspaper reads, "Terrorism strikes again in the heart of Paris. An attack claimed by Islamic State in which left one policeman dead and two seriously injured. As for the gunman, he was shot dead by police." Well, late last night, the French president, François Hollande, gave this brief statement.
J'ai convoqué un conseil de défense demain matin à 8 heures.
I have convened a crisis meeting for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Our security forces, our police, our military police will remain on the highest state of alert, as has been the case for a few months. And we will remain very vigilant, especially in light of the upcoming election.
Well, while all that was happening, the 11 candidates vying for the presidency were making their final pitch to voters on TV. The attack prompted this live reaction from the centrist frontrunner Emmanuel Macron.
Nous aspirons tous et toutes à devenir.
We all aspire to become president of the Republic, and the first duty of the president is to protect. Tonight, while we've been talking, we know that at least one police officer has been killed. This threat is incalculable, and it's going to be part of our daily lives for years to come.
We'll find out more about the impact the attack had on those pre-election televised interviews. I spoke to Hélène Becmezian, deputy editor-in-chief of the online edition of the French daily Le Monde.
It was very strange because we didn't know exactly what happened and we didn't know how many people were killed. We knew one policeman were killed, but then there was a rumor about a second one. So on the television, the journalist said things that were false. So the candidate were commenting something without knowing exactly what was happening.
Is this the kind of issue which would favour one candidate rather than another? I don't know if any one of them were taking perhaps a sort of stronger line regarding these sort of terror attacks.
Well, there's Marine Le Pen from the far-right party who always said, we don't do enough to protect the French people. So maybe it's in favor for her, this kind of event. And maybe for François Fillon also from the right party. So yeah, maybe for these two candidates, this could be kind of a good thing.
And just looking ahead to the actual sort of when we get to election day, there might be a fear also with with fear on the streets of France and other cities, whether it could, you know, affect the turnout on election day.
It's really, really, really hard to say, because even without this shooting, without these attacks, we've never seen an election like this before. We have four candidates. We don't know which one are going to be on the second term. And it's impossible to know what's going to happen on Sunday. Everything can happen.
Can I ask you about the actual television, let's call them interviews, because it wasn't really a debate. Did we learn anything that we didn't know before about any of the candidates?
No, not really, because now the campaign, it's the end of the campaign. So we know all of the 11 candidates. We know the big lines of their programs. There was nothing new tonight. Actually, we are all wondering what was really the object.
The point of it,
exactly.
Because French people have had enough. I mean, there's been, and when you've got 11 candidates, I mean, it's just, even the last debate, it lasted 4 hours, and this one they had, 15 minutes each. It's just an eternity.
Yes, it's an eternity. It's very long. Everybody is fed up with this campaign. Everybody wants to be on Sunday, wants to know who is going to run for the second term. So this debate, I don't know if there were many people on television. I don't think so, because people are really, they're fed up with everything. They have seen too much political show, too much people on TV, and now we want it to end.
Hélène Beck-Mézian of Le Monde newspaper. Worth noting also that a lot of the papers picking up today on the fact that at least three of those candidates, Emmanuel Macron, Marine Le Pen and François Fillon, have all cancelled planned rallies today in France.
You're listening to Newsday on the BBC World Service, live from London with Julian Keane, and live from Idaho with me, Shaima Khalil. Moving on from French politics to American politics. We're here in Idaho, also known as the Gem State, a conservative state with a big rural community which voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump. We're in Boise, the capital, and it could not be more different from its rural surroundings. This is a really cool, buzzing area, bustling with restaurants and shops. We're actually not very far from somewhere called Freak Alley. Don't be scared. It's an alley with all sorts of really cool graffiti and street art. I tweeted some of the pictures. Have a look at them. Why are we here in Boise? Well, because it's very, very cool. That's one reason, but also because it's coming up to the 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. This is the last leg of our road trip across America. We're also not very far from the Basque block. There's a big Basque community here in Boise, and I'm with one very famous Basque American, the mayor of Boise, Mayor David Beter. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you and welcome. Ongi etorri, as you said. Welcome in Basque.
I couldn't say it. Julian did very, very
he
well.
Did well.
I'm not gonna attempt Basque right now. Thank you very much for having us. I mean, as I mentioned there, Americans all over the country, there's a big media frenzy, obviously, looking at the 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. I understand, of course, you're a Democrat. You have been a big supporter of the former president, President Obama. I'm just wondering, looking at the first 100 days, what do you make of them so far?
Well, I think he's been ineffective. I think you have to objectively take a look at this, and he's not done anything he set out to do. I am emboldened by the fact that our institutions have held, because it's very frightening to have an authoritarian figure like Trump in the presidency. I lived in the Basque Country under a time of Franco. I understand what that looks like close up, and I am encouraged, although concerned, but in 100 days he's been ineffective. I think any look of that, he's unpopular, and let's hope he continues to be ineffective. The midterm elections will tell an awful lot.
Well, his supporters will wholeheartedly disagree with that, and we have been speaking to many of his supporters across Idaho, and we'll hear from them. But just before we let you go, Mayor, if people, for someone who doesn't know anything about Boise, what could they do when they get here?
Oh, they can do anything they want. We are, again, at where the desert meets the mountains. You can ski, you can white rider raft, mountain bike in our foothills. We are a paradise of things to do. So please come here. It's an idyllic area. We're also very prosperous, a high-tech community that's very active. Come and see us. You won't want to leave.
Mayor Beter, thank you so much for that. More to come from across Idaho and a little bit of music coming your way as well.
Can't wait. You're with Newsday here on the BBC World Service. Now, many of our listeners, especially those in Zimbabwe, will remember this impassioned speech.
This is the time that a change must happen. Quit standing on the sidelines and watching this flag fly and wishing for a future that you are not at all wanting to get involved in. This flag, every day that it flies, is begging for you to get involved, is begging for you to say something, is begging for you to cry out and to say, why must we be in the situation that we are in? This flag, it's your flag, it's my flag. This flag.
That was Pastor Evan Mawarire a year ago expressing his frustrations at the way his country was being run. Well, that online recording went viral and sparked a campaign using the hashtag This Flag. As more and more people supported his call for political reforms, it even led to a general strike in Zimbabwe. It also got the pastor in trouble. He was arrested before later being released by the court. 3 months ago, Pastor Maria was detained again. Later today, he's due to appear in court, where he faces charges of subversion, inciting public violence, and insulting the national flag. Well, for reaction, I've been speaking to Silvanus Mudzvova, a political activist who himself has clashed with the Zimbabwean authorities in the past. He left the country earlier this year and is currently living here in the UK. So how worried is he about the situation currently facing Pastor Maria?
I'm really worried to an extent that EU is not so sure what is actually going to happen to him. But at the same time, we are sort of having the feeling that it's going to be a routine remand so that he will actually be able to go back to his house and sleep.
What does his case tell us about the difficulties in being someone who opposes the Zimbabwean regime and government?
His case actually clearly indicates the level of panic that the government has got. They fear a lot if people begin to speak out. They fear a lot if people begin to engage them one-on-one. Pastor Mawarire was asking simple questions. He wanted school fees for his children. This is like what is happening to most of us as the youth. We are so educated. In terms of education, I think we are the second most educated country in Africa after Tunisia. But you will find that 90% of those with degrees, they do not have jobs. So the minute that you start speaking about these things, they panic a lot because they just want people who actually listen to the propaganda that they give to the people. And the minute that you want to start to talk about it, you actually become a target of them.
But of course, it can be argued that taking a stand like this against what is an authoritarian regime, well, you know, it's asking for trouble. So surely you can't be surprised that he finds himself today on the wrong side of the law.
We cannot all be silent as Zimbabweans. Look at the rate of unemployment. The country at the moment doesn't have any money at all. And the corruption that is happening in the country. Ministers are looting everything from the country. And they want us to be silent about those things. We can't be silent. We've got a future that is ahead of us as young people, which is the same thing that happened to the pastor. You saw that our future is actually being taken by this old guard that is there. I mean, look at a 93-year-old president. Can he do anything which can actually safeguard the future of us? He's only thinking about himself.
But not all of those, even among those who are opposed to the regime, are convinced by the sort of action the pastor is taking. The opposition leader, Joyce Mujuru, has described him as a mere social media sensation.
She also belongs to the older generation. You realize the role of social media in today's politics. They've got so much fear in terms of even going into the streets. But when the pastor came in with this innovative idea of using social media, it actually brought an interest in so many young people who are actually not even interested in the politics of the country, which is one thing whereby I totally differ with the politician, with all respect that I give here. But on this one, she's really lost.
Zimbabwean political activist, now living in the UK, Silvanus Mudvova. Now, looking at the British papers here, all the front pages have that story on the Paris terror attack. If you look at the back pages where you find all the sports news, there's news of, well, some good and bad news for Manchester United. Let's find out more with the sports with Alistair Ross.
The good news is that Manchester United are through, of course, to the semi-final of the Europa League. They beat Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time at Old Trafford and have gone through 3-2 on aggregate. But the bad news, that the win came at the cost of potentially serious knee injuries to Marcus Rojo and to Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Even though United have been reliant on the Swedes' goals, arguably Rojo's injury is the more worrying. United have other strikers, but with Chris Smalling and Phil Jones also injured, they are running out of defenders, and Mourinho is calling on the two English players to hurry their return.
And I think it's time for Jones and Smalling to be brave, to risk, because for the team, you have to do everything. That's the way I think. You cannot do miracles, so miracles I don't expect, but you have to try to do everything to accelerate the process.
United was one of the three quarter-finals to require extra time as well. Ajax fought back with 10 men to beat the German club Schalke 4-3 on aggregate. Lyon knocked out Besiktas on penalties in the end. Celta Vigo's 1-1 draw with Genk was enough to see the Spanish club through over two legs. They go into the Europa League draw as well. That is made on Friday, straight after the Champions League draw, where Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Monaco and Juventus will find out who they will face in the semi-finals. The Cleveland Cavaliers have completed a stunning comeback to overhaul what at one stage was a 26-point lead for the Indiana Pacers. A 119-114 win leaves them just one game away from the conference semi-finals. And LeBron James also picked up an NBA milestone in that match. He passed Kobe Bryant to become the third highest scoring player in NBA postseason history. Only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan have more. The Milwaukee Bucks are on court against the Toronto Raptors at the moment, on course to take a 2-1 lead in the series, and the San Antonio Spurs pretty much tied up at the moment with the Memphis Grizzlies. Tiger Woods has had another operation on his back. It's his fourth and is likely to rule him out for the rest of the PGA Tour season. The 14-time major winner says he needed more relief from back and neck pain. Ethiopia's Feyisa Lelisa says he will make an anti-government sign again if he achieves success at the London Marathon this weekend. The Olympic silver medalist is living in exile in the USA, saying he's scared he'll be killed if he returns home because of the gesture he made on the podium in Rio.
Automatically they will kill me. If they not kill me, they put in jail. If not put in jail, they close in airport. I cannot see any other country ever again. How can I regret? I come from the people. My people is dying still. I never regret. I will make again stronger.
Well, the Ethiopian government maintains that he would be welcomed as a hero if he were to return. And the former world snooker champion Neil Robertson says his career has suffered because of an addiction to computer games. The Australian says he's not played one in 2 months because he knows that when he starts, he can easily play them for 12 hours straight. And he says other sports and other players have the same issue.
Thanks, Alistair. Let's go to Cameroon now, and perhaps a sigh of relief today for a big chunk of the country now able to log on and go online. Internet services across the English-speaking part of Cameroon have been cut off. That was 3 months ago. This followed a wave of protest by English speakers who were complaining about feeling marginalised in what is a majority francophone country. The unrest really kicked off following a decision to impose the use of French in schools and in the courts. Kawala is a leading opposition politician who was active in the Bring Back Our Internet campaign. It's now up and running again, and this was her reaction to the news.
We're thrilled. This is over 5 million people who now have their basic right to information back. So I think the first reaction is just relief to have Cameroonians who are in the northwest and southwest able to communicate with the rest of the world again.
Give me an idea of the sort of impact it's been for people in those parts of the country living without the internet. It must have had quite a big impact.
It's had a huge impact. First of all, basic services and businesses have not been able to function. So banks, money transfer. People have not been able to communicate socially. A lot of families have family members who are in other parts of the country or even outside the country, and they count on the internet to be able to communicate. And then government itself has not been able to provide many services. Customs services, immigration services, and so on have been completely down in those two regions. And finally, the southwest of Cameroon is actually the hub of internet entrepreneurs in our country. Boya Mountain, which is the second highest mountain in Africa, at the foot of the mountain is this internet entrepreneurs hub. So we call it Silicon Mountain. And they have lost millions of dollars because they are completely dependent on the internet for their business.
So it's all back on again, but there is always this fear that it could simply be switched off again.
Yes, this episode has completely deteriorated trust in the government because we don't know why they shut it off in the first place, and we're not quite certain why they've turned it on today, which means then that we live in incertitude with regard to our basic rights.
And the reality of the situation is, because the president, you know, even as he was announcing the internet would be switched back on, said he could turn it off again at any time. The reality of that is that you're just going to have to accept whatever measures are imposed by the central government regarding the imposition of French and so forth. Because if you don't, the internet will just be turned back off again.
That is the implication, because we have to remember that this situation comes out of people demanding their right to be able to get an education, get justice in a language that they can understand. And the fundamental demands still have to be met.
So the fight continues for that English-speaking community in Cameroon. Kawala, a leading opposition politician there.
This is Newsday on the BBC World Service, live from London with Julian Keane and with me, Shaima Khalil, in Idaho, in northwestern United States, a state with a big rural community known for its forests in the north, deserts in the south, and for backing President Trump through and through. We started this road trip in the lead-up to the 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency, not very far from the Capitol in West Virginia, and we're now all the way in the northwest, very, very far from the Capitol. Potatoes are big here, but so is fiddling. Folk violin playing, that is, also huge in Idaho, and I went to find out why.
My name is Ken Pollard. We are currently in Nampa, Idaho, which is in the western United States. I make violins, I repair violins, I try to play them. We just played a dance last night up in Moscow, Idaho.
Would you say that what drew you to it was the culture, the, you know, the folk music, the making of it, the repairing of it, or all of it?
The music first. My parents listened to folk music, and so I grew up listening to all that sort of music, and it just becomes part of how you think about things. You're humming tunes in your head as you go down the street.
Now, I understand you studied physics and bioengineering.
Yes.
So what does a physicist and a bioengineer do with a workshop full of violins?
If you can do physics, then you believe that you can actually do anything, right?
So I do physics. Let me just build violins.
That's right. I mean, how hard can it be, right? And that's a mistake to think that way as well, because it's very hard. And the more you know, the more you see in them. But they're fascinating. I mean, how can this little box make that sound that can just fill an entire symphony hall, right?
We're talking about violins and we're looking at them, but if I look at the sign of your shop, it's Owyhee Mountain Fiddle Shop. So what's the difference between a fiddle and a violin?
They kind of describe the same instrument, but the violin is the technical term for it, and a fiddle is kind of the friendly term for it. And over time, I've come to appreciate that, in fact, in addition to being the musical instrument and the tool it is, it's actually a piece of sculpture, too, so I'm spending more time trying to make my curves better.
connected is fiddling to the history of Idaho and the culture here?
You know, it was a very popular thing from 1800 on. Let's say that's 1800 to 1920. People had no TVs, no radios, nothing like that. And so fiddle was an instrument that was portable. Also, they're complicated structures, but they're fairly simple to repair. So if something went wrong with it, people could find someone who could put it back together for them.
Would you say that fiddling and folk music in general, is Idaho one of the centers of that?
I don't know that Idaho is a center of anything, but but we like it. And every time I go somewhere, I meet someone who fiddles.
So there you go. A bit of fiddling, folk music for you there. And really interesting how our guest was saying that, you know, the violin player is saying, Idaho isn't really the center for anything. I'm here with Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio. Thank you for being with us, Frankie.
I'm so glad to be here, Shaima. It's a pleasure.
I know that, you know, you have been, we've been talking a lot about, you know, what do you do in Boise? What do people do other than fiddling, of course, which sounds like it's big here. You've been taking me around a tour. Boise is actually quite interesting because it's very different from its rural surroundings.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a growing city. It's changing really rapidly. There's a lot of new buildings in downtown. There's a strong, you know, beer culture here. We're surrounded by it. We are right now. There's a lot of people drinking local beers at the moment. There's also a strong arts and culture scene here. A lot of young people who are sticking around. We visited a particular alley that maybe we'll get to later.
Freak Alley.
Freak Alley, yeah, exactly. So there's a lot going on, and it's changing quickly. There's more people moving here, people who are coming here for university and sticking around, and that might not have been true, you know, 20 years ago. It is a growing population, and people want to be here. They want to be here for recreation. We heard from Mayor Dave Beter earlier about, you know, mountain biking and hiking and all of that. It's right in our back door. So, you know, a lot of people think about places like Boulder, Colorado in the West and other spots. But Boise is kind of an up-and-coming place that does a lot of the same things.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, politically how Boise is very different from its surroundings as well, because the state is very red. Boise is very blue.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a blue dot in a red sea, definitely. Idaho went very strongly for President Trump. Boise itself went for Clinton, but the county that Boise is in actually went for Trump. So there's a real dichotomy. Boise is the capital city, and the capital is all Republican, almost completely. The Republicans have a very strong hold over the state, both on the executive level, but also in the state house.
Frankie, stay with us. We're going to talk a lot more about the politics here and how much people follow the politics of Washington. We're here live in Boise, Idaho, in the northwest of the United States. Coming up on the program, we'll take you to the forests of Idaho and speak to a logger who calls himself the woods boss. We'll know more about what his concerns are, logging and politics. We're here to look at the first 100 days of the Trump presidency and what people here make of it. Stay tuned from me with more from all around Idaho in the Northwest. You're listening to Newsday.
This is the BBC World Service. And on The Inquiry this week,
almost 2 billion people have Facebook profiles, but many of us don't realize how much information we're giving away and what it can be used